Hello and welcome. I'm Jennifer March, and this is not your mother's story time. It's Winesburg, Ohio again this week. The next three stories are Respectability, The Thinker, and Tandy. Some believe that Anderson took stories and characters from Clyde, Ohio, where he lived from 8 to 19 years old. He says, "The hint for almost every character was taken from my fellow lodgers in a large rooming house. These lodgers were the young musicians, young writers, painters, and actors, and others that lived in proximity to Anderson on the north side of Chicago, and to whom he referred as the little children of the arts." The truth probably lies somewhere in between. And now, Respectability, concerning Wash Williams. If you have lived in cities and walked in the park on a summer afternoon, you have perhaps seen blinking in a corner of his iron cage a huge, grotesque kind of monkey, a creature with ugly, sagging, hairless skin below his eyes and a bright purple underbody. This monkey is a true monster. In the completeness of his ugliness, he achieved a kind of perverted beauty. Children stopping before the cage are fascinated. Men turn away with an air of disgust. And women linger for a moment, trying perhaps to remember which one of their male acquaintances the thing in some faint way resembles. Had you been in the early years of your life a citizen of the village of Winesburg, Ohio, there would have been for you no mystery in regard to the beast in his cage. "It is like Wash Williams," you would have said. "As he sits in the corner there, the beast is exactly like old Wash, sitting on the grass in the station yard on a summer evening after he has closed his office for the night." Wash Williams, the telegraph operator of Winesburg, was the ugliest thing in town. His girth was immense, his neck thin, his legs feeble. He was dirty. Everything about him was unclean. Even the whites of his eyes looked soiled. I go too fast. Not everything about Wash was unclean. He took care of his hands. His fingers were fat, but there was something sensitive and shapely in the hands that lay on the table by the instrument in the telegraph office. In his youth, Wash Williams had been called the best telegraph operator in the state, and in spite of his degradement to the obscure office at Winesburg, he was still proud of his ability. Wash Williams did not associate with the men of the town in which he lived. "I'll have nothing to do with them," he said, looking with bleary eyes at the men who walked along the station platform past the telegraph office. Up along Main Street, he went in the evening to Griffith's Saloon, and after drinking unbelievable quantities of beer, staggered off to his room in the New Willard House and to his bed for the night. Wash Williams was a man of courage. A thing had happened to him that made him hate life, and he hated it wholeheartedly, with the abandon of a poet. First of all, he hated women. "Bitches," he called them. His feeling toward men was somewhat different. He pitied them. "Does not every man let his life be managed for him by some bitch or another?" he asked. In Winesburg, no attention was paid to Wash Williams and his hatred of his fellows. Once, Mrs. White, the banker's wife, complained to the telegraph company, saying that the office in Winesburg was dirty and smelled abominably. But nothing came of her complaint. Here and there, a man respected the operator. Instinctively, the man felt in him a glowing resentment of something he had not the courage to resent. When Wash walked through the streets, such a one had an instinct to pay him homage, to raise his hat, or to bow before him. The superintendent, who had supervised over the telegraph operators on the railroad that went through Winesburg, felt that way. He had put Wash into an obscure office in Winesburg to avoid discharging him, and he meant to keep him there. When he received the letter of complaint from the banker's wife, he tore it up and laughed unpleasantly. For some reason, he thought of his own wife as he tore up the letter. Wash Williams once had a wife. When he was still a young man, he married a woman in Dayton, Ohio. The woman was tall and slender, and had blue eyes and yellow hair. Wash was himself a comely youth. He loved the woman with a love as absorbing as the hatred he later felt for all women. In all of Winesburg, there was but one person who knew the story of the thing that had made ugly the person and the character of Wash Williams. He once told the story to George Willard, and the telling of the tale came about in this way. George Willard went one evening to walk with Belle Carpenter, a trimmer of women's hats, who worked in a millinery shop kept by Mrs. Kate McHugh. The young man was not in love with the woman, who in fact had a suitor, who worked as bartender in Griffith's saloon, but as they walked about under the trees, they occasionally embraced. The night and their own thoughts had aroused something in them. As they were returning to Main Street, they passed the little lawn beside the railroad station and saw Wash Williams apparently asleep on the grass beneath a tree. On the next evening, the operator and George Willard walked out together. Down the railroad they went and sat on a pile of decaying railroad ties beside the tracks. It was then that the operator told the young reporter his story of hate. Perhaps a dozen times George Willard and the strange, shapeless man who lived at his father's hotel had been on the point of talking. The young man looked at the hideous, leering face staring about the hotel dining room and was consumed with curiosity. Something he saw lurking in the staring eyes told him that the man who had nothing to say to others had nevertheless something to say to him. On the pile of railroad ties on the summer evening, he waited expectantly. When the operator remained silent and seemed to have changed his mind about talking, he tried to make conversation. "Were you ever married, Mr. Williams?" he began. "I suppose you were, and your wife is dead, is that it?" Wash Williams spat forth a succession of vile oaths. "Yes, she is dead," he agreed. "She is dead as all women are dead. She is a living dead thing, walking in the sight of men and making the earth foul by her presence." Staring into the boy's eyes, the man became purple with rage. "Don't have fool notions in your head," he commanded. "My wife, she is dead. Yes, surely. I tell you, all women are dead. My mother, your mother, that tall, dark woman who works in the millinery store, and with whom I saw you walking about yesterday, all of them are dead. All of them. They are all dead. I tell you, there is something rotten about them. I was married, sure. My wife was dead before she married me. She was a foul thing, come out a woman more foul. She was a thing sent to make life unbearable to me. I was a fool, do you see, as you are now. And so I married this woman. I would like to see men a little begin to understand women. They are sent to prevent men making the world worthwhile. It is a trick in nature. Oh, they are creeping, crawling, squirming things. They with their soft hands and their blue eyes. The sight of a woman sickens me. Why I don't kill every woman I see, I don't know." Half frightened and yet fascinated by the light burning in the eyes of the hideous old man, George Willard listened, afire with curiosity. Darkness came on, and he leaned forward, trying to see the face of the old man who talked. When in the gathering darkness he could no longer see the purple, bloated face and the burning eyes, a curious fancy came to him. Wash Williams talked in low, even tones that made his words seem the more terrible. In the darkness, the young reporter found himself imagining that he sat on the railroad ties beside a comely young man with black hair and black shiny eyes. There was something almost beautiful in the voice of Wash Williams, the hideous, telling his story of hate. The telegraph operator of Winesburg, sitting in the darkness on the railroad ties, had become a poet. Hatred had raised him to that elevation.
It is because I saw you kissing the lips of that Bell Carpenter that I tell you my story, he said. What happened to me may next happen to you. I want to put you on your guard. Already, you may be having dreams in your head. I want to destroy them.
Wash Williams began telling the story of his married life with the tall blonde girl with the blue eyes, whom he had met when he was a young operator at Dayton, Ohio. Here and there his story was touched with moments of beauty, intermingled with strings of vile curses. The operator had married the daughter of a dentist, who was the youngest of three sisters. On his marriage day, because of his ability, he was promoted to a position as dispatcher at an increased salary and sent to an office at Columbus, Ohio. There he settled down with his young wife and began buying a house on the installment plan. The young telegraph operator was madly in love. With a kind of religious fervor, he had managed to go through the pitfalls of his youth and to remain virginal until after his marriage. He made for George Willard a picture of his life in the house at Columbus, Ohio, with the young wife.
In the garden back of our house, we planted vegetables, he said. You know, peas and corn and such things. We went to Columbus in early March, and as soon as the days became warm, I went to work in the garden. With a spade, I turned up the black ground, while she ran about laughing and pretending to be afraid of worms I uncovered. Late in April came the planting. In the little paths among the seed beds, she stood, holding a paper bag in her hand. The bag was filled with seeds. A few at a time, she handed me the seeds, that I might thrust them into the warm, soft ground.
For a moment, there was a catch in the voice of the man talking in the darkness.
I loved her, he said. I don't claim not to be a fool. I loved her yet. There in the dusk in the spring evening, I crawled along the black ground to her feet and groveled before her. I kissed her shoes and the ankles above her shoes. When the hem of her garment touched my face, I trembled. When after 2 years of that life, I found she had managed to acquire three other lovers who came regularly to our house when I was away at work. I didn't want to touch them or her. I just sent her home to her mother and said nothing. There was nothing to say. I had $400 in the bank, and I gave her that. I didn't ask for her reasons. I didn't say anything. When she had gone, I cried like a silly boy. Pretty soon I had a chance to sell the house, and I sent that money to her.
Wash Williams and George Willard arose from the pile of railroad ties and walked along the tracks toward the town. The operator finished his tale quickly, breathlessly.
Her mother sent for me, he said. She wrote me a letter and asked me to come to their house at Dayton. When I got there, it was evening, about this time.
Wash Williams' voice rose to a half scream.
I sat in the parlor of that house 2 hours. Her mother took me in there and left me. Their house was stylish. They were what is called respectable people. There were plush chairs and a couch in the room. I was trembling all over. I hated the men I thought had wronged her. I was sick of living alone and wanted her back. The longer I waited, the more raw and tender I became. I thought that if she came in and just touched me with her hand, I would perhaps faint away. I ached to forgive and forget.
Wash Williams stopped and stood staring at George Willard. The boy's body shook as from a chill. Again the man's voice became soft and low.
She came into the room, naked.
He went on.
Her mother did that. While I sat there, she was taking the girl's clothes off, perhaps coaxing her to do it. First, I heard voices at the door that led into a little hallway, and then it opened softly. The girl was ashamed and stood perfectly still, staring at the floor. Mother didn't come into the room. When she had pushed the girl in through the door, she stood in the hallway, waiting. hoping we would... Well, you see, waiting.
George Willard and the telegraph operator came into the main street of Winesburg. The lights from the store windows lay bright and shining on the sidewalks. People moved about, laughing and talking. The young reporter felt ill and weak. In imagination, he also became old and shapeless.
I didn't get the mother killed,
says Wash Williams, staring up and down the street.
I struck her once with a chair, and then the neighbors came in and took it away. She screamed so loud, you see. I won't ever have a chance to kill her now. She died of a fever a month after that happened.
The Thinker, concerning Seth Richmond. The house in which Seth Richmond of Winesburg lived with his mother had been at one time the showplace of the town. But when young Seth lived there, its glory had become somewhat dimmed. The huge brick house, which Banker White had built on Buckeye Street, had overshadowed it. The Richmond place was in a little valley, far out at the end of Main Street. Farmers coming into town by a dusty road from the south, past a grove of walnut trees, skirted the fairgrounds with its high board fence covered with advertisements, and trotted their horses down through the valley past the Richmond place into town. As much of the country north and south of Winesburg was devoted to fruit and berry raising, Seth saw wagon loads of berry pickers, boys, girls, and women, going to the fields in the morning and returning covered with dust in the evening. The chattering crowd, with their rude jokes, cried out from wagon to wagon, sometimes irritated him sharply. He regretted that he also could not laugh boisterously, shout meaningless jokes, and make of himself a figure in the endless stream of moving, giggling activity that went up and down the road. The Richmond house was built of limestone, and although it was said in the village to have become run down, had in reality grown more beautiful with every passing year. Already time had begun a little to color the stone, lending a gold richness to its surface, and in the evening, or on dark days, touching the shaded places beneath the eaves with wavering patches of browns and blacks. The house had been built by Seth's grandfather, a stone quarryman, and it, together with the stone quarries on Lake Erie, 18 miles to the north, had been left to his son, Clarence Richmond, Seth's father. Clarence Richmond, a quiet, passionate man, extraordinarily admired by his neighbors, had been killed in a street fight with the editor of a newspaper in Toledo, Ohio. The fight concerned the publication of Clarence Richmond's name, coupled with that of a woman schoolteacher. And as the dead man had begun the row by firing upon the editor, the effort to punish the slayer was unsuccessful. After the quarryman's death, it was found that much of the money left to him had been squandered in speculation and in insecure investments made through the influence of friends. Left with but a small income, Virginia Richmond had settled down to a retired life in the village and to the raising of her son. Although she had been deeply moved by the death of the husband and father, she did not at all believe the stories concerning him that ran about after his death. To her mind, the sensitive boyish man, whom all had instinctively loved, was but an unfortunate, a being too fine for everyday life. "You'll be hearing all sorts of stories, but you are not to believe what you hear," she said to her son. "He was a good man, full of tenderness for everyone, and should not have tried to be a man of affairs. No matter how much I were to plan and dream of your future, I could not imagine anything better for you than that you turn out as good a man as your father." Several years after the death of her husband, Virginia Richmond had become alarmed at the growing demands upon her income, and had set herself to the task of increasing it. She had learned stenography, and through the influence of her husband's friends, got the position of court stenographer at the county seat. There she went by train each morning during the sessions of the court, and when no court sat, spent her days working among the rose bushes in her garden. She was a tall, straight figure of a woman, with a plain face and a great mass of brown hair. In the relationship between Seth Richmond and his mother, there was a quality that even at 18 had begun to color all of his traffic with men. An almost unhealthy respect for the youth kept the mother, for the most part, silent in his presence. When she did speak sharply to him, he had only to look steadily into her eyes to see dawning there the puzzled look he had already noticed in the eyes of others when he looked at them. The truth was that the son thought with remarkable clearness, and the mother did not. She expected from all people certain conventional reactions to life. A boy was your son. You scolded him, and he trembled and looked at the floor. When you had scolded enough, he wept, and all was forgiven. After the weeping, and when he had gone to bed, you crept into his room and kissed him. Virginia Richmond could not understand why her son did not do these things. After the severest reprimand, he did not tremble and look at the floor, but instead looked steadily at her, causing uneasy doubts to invade her mind. As for creeping into his room, after Seth had passed his 15th year, she would have been half afraid to do anything of the kind. Once, when he was a boy of 16, Seth, in company with two other boys, ran away from home. The three boys climbed into the open door of an empty freight car and rode some 40 miles to a town where a fair was being held. One of the boys had a bottle filled with a combination of whiskey and blackberry wine, and the three of them sat with legs dangling out of the car door, drinking from the bottle. Seth's two companions sang and waved their hands to idlers about the station of the towns through which the train passed. They planned raids upon the baskets of farmers who had come with their families to the fair. "We will take five like kings, and we won't have to spend a penny to see the fair and racehorses," they declared boastfully. After the disappearance of Seth, Virginia Richmond walked up and down the floor of her home, filled with vague alarms. Although on the next day she discovered, through an inquiry made by the town marshal, on what adventures the boys had gone, she could not quiet herself. All through the night she lay awake, hearing the clock tick, and telling herself that Seth, like his father, would come to a sudden and violent end. So determined was she that the boy should this time feel the weight of her wrath, that although she would not allow the marshal to interfere with his adventure, she got out a pencil and paper and wrote down a series of sharp, stinging reproofs she intended to pour out upon him. The reproofs she committed to memory, going about the garden and saying them aloud like an actor memorizing his part. And when, at the end of the week, Seth returned, a little weary and with coal soot in his ears and about his eyes, she again found herself unable to reprove him. Walking into the house, he hung his cap on a nail by the kitchen door and stood looking steadily at her. "I wanted to turn back within an hour after we had started," he explained. "I didn't know what to do. I knew you'd be bothered. But I knew also that if I didn't go on, I would be ashamed of myself. I went through with the thing for my own good. It was uncomfortable, sleeping on wet straw, and two drunken men came and slept with us. When I stole a lunch basket out of a farmer's wagon, I couldn't help thinking of his children going all day without food. I was sick of the whole affair, but I was determined to stick it out until the other boys were ready to come back."
"I'm glad you did stick it out," replied the mother, half resentfully, and kissing him upon the forehead, pretended to busy herself with the work about the house. On a summer evening, Seth Richmond went to the New Willard House to visit his friend, George Willard. It had rained during the afternoon, but as he walked through Main Street, the sky had partially cleared, and a golden glow lit up the west. Going around a corner, he turned in at the door of the hotel and began to climb the stairway leading up to his friend's room. In the hotel office, the proprietor and two traveling men were engaged in a discussion of politics. On the stairway, Seth stopped and listened to the voices of the men below. They were excited and talked rapidly. Tom Willard was berating the travelman.
"I am a Democrat, but your talk makes me sick," he said. "You don't understand McKinley. McKinley and Mark Hanna are friends. It is impossible, perhaps, for your mind to grasp that. If anyone tells you that a friendship can be deeper and bigger and more worthwhile than dollars and cents, or even more worthwhile than state politics, you snicker and laugh."
The landlord was interrupted by one of the guests, a tall, gray-mustached man who worked for a wholesale grocery house.
"Do you think that I live in Cleveland all these years without knowing Mark Hanna?" he demanded. "Your talk is piffle. Hanna is after money and nothing else. This McKinley is his tool. He has McKinley bluffed, and don't you forget it."
The young man on the stairs did not linger to hear the rest of the discussion, but went on up the stairway and into the little dark hall. Something in the voices of the men talking in the hotel office started a chain of thoughts in his mind. He was lonely, and had begun to think that loneliness was a part of his character, something that would always stay with him. Stepping into a side hall, he stood by a window that looked out into an alleyway. At the back of his shop stood Abner Groff, the town baker, his tiny bloodshot eyes looking up and down the alleyway. In his shop, someone called the baker, who pretended not to hear. The baker had an empty milk bottle in his hand and an angry, sullen look in his eyes. In Winesburg, Seth Richmond was called the Deep One. "He's like his father," men said as he went through the streets. "He'll break out some of these days, you wait and see." The talk of the town and the respect with which men and boys instinctively greeted him, as all men greet silent people, had affected Seth Richmond's outlook on life and on himself. He, like most boys, was deeper than boys are given credit for being, but he was not what the men of the town, and even his mother, thought him to be. No great underlying purpose lay back of his habitual silence, and he had no definite plan for his life. When the boys with whom he associated were noisy and quarrelsome, he stood quietly at one side. With calm eyes, he watched the gesticulating, lively figures of his companions. He wasn't particularly interested in what was going on, and sometimes wondered if he would ever be particularly interested in anything. Now, as he stood in the half-darkness by the window watching the baker, he wished that he himself might become thoroughly stirred by something, even by the fits of sullen anger for which Baker Groff was noted.
"It would be better for me if I could become excited and wrangle about politics like windy old Tom Willard," he thought, as he left the window and went again along the hallway to the room occupied by his friend, George Willard.
George Willard was older than Seth Richmond, but in the rather odd friendship between the two, it was he who was forever courting and the younger boy who was being courted. The paper on which George worked had one policy. It strove to mention by name in each issue as many as possible of the inhabitants of the village. Like an excited dog, George Willard ran here and there, noting on his pad of paper who had gone on business to the country seat or who had returned from a visit to a neighboring village. All day he wrote little facts upon the pad.
AP. Ringlet had received a shipment of straw hats. Ed Beyerbaum and Tom Marshall were in Cleveland Friday. Uncle Tom Sinnings is building a new barn on his place on the Valley Road.
The idea that George Willard could someday become a writer had given him a place of distinction in Winesburg, and to Seth Richmond he talked continually of the matter.
"It's the easiest of all lives to live,"
he declared, becoming excited and boastful.
"Here and there you go, and there is no one to boss you. Though you are in India or in the South Seas in a boat, you have but to write, and there you are. Wait till I get my name up, and then see what fun I shall have."
In George Willard's room, which had a window looking down into an alleyway and one that looked across railroad tracks to Biff Carter's lunchroom facing the railroad station, Seth Richmond sat in a chair and looked at the floor. George Willard, who had been sitting for an hour idly playing with a lead pencil, greeted him effusively.
"I've been trying to write a love story," he explained, laughing nervously.
Lighting a pipe, he began to walk up and down the room.
"I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to fall in love. I've been sitting here and thinking it over, and I'm going to do it."
As though embarrassed by his declaration, George went to a window and, turning his back to his friend, leaned out.
"I know who I'm going to fall in love with," he said sharply. "It's Helen White. She's the only girl in town with any get-up to her."
Struck with a new idea, young Willard turned and walked toward his visitor.
"Look here," he said. "You know Helen White better than I do. I want you to tell her what I said. You just get to talking to her, and say that I'm in love with her. See what she says to that. See how she takes it. And then you come and tell me.
Seth Richmond arose and went toward the door. The words of his comrade irritated him unbearably.
Well, goodbye, he said briefly.
George was amazed. Running forward, he stood in the darkness trying to look into Seth's face.
What's the matter? What are you going to do? You stay here and let's talk, he urged.
A wave of resentment directed against his friend, the men of the town who were, he thought, perpetually talking of nothing, and most of all against his own habit of silence, made Seth half desperate.
Ah, speak to her yourself,
he burst forth, and then, going quickly through the door, slammed it sharply in his friend's face.
I'm gonna find Helen White and talk to her, but not about him, he muttered.
Seth went down the stairway and out the front door of the hotel, muttering with wrath. Crossing a little dusty street and climbing a low iron railing, he went to sit upon the grass in the station yard. George Willard, he thought, a profound fool, and he wished that he had said so more vigorously. Although his acquaintanceship with Helen White, the banker's daughter, was outwardly but casual, she was often the subject of his thoughts, and he felt that she was something private and personal to himself.
Busy fool with his love stories, he muttered,
staring back over his shoulder at George Willard's room.
Why does he never tire of his eternal talking?
It was berry harvest time in Winesburg, and upon the station platform, men and boys loaded the boxes of red, fragrant berries into two express cars that stood upon the siding. A June moon was in the sky, although in the west a storm threatened, and no street lamps were lighted. In the dim light, the figures of the men standing upon the express truck and pitching the boxes in at the doors of the cars were but dimly discernible. Upon the iron railing that protected the station lawn sat other men. Pipes were lighted. Village jokes went back and forth. Away in the distance, a train whistled, and the men loading the boxes into the cars worked with renewed activity. Seth arose from his place on the grass and went silently past the men perched upon the railing and into Main Street. He had come to a resolution.
I'll get out of here, he told himself. What good am I here? I'm going to go to some city and go to work. I'll tell Mother about it tomorrow.
Seth Richmond went slowly along Main Street, past Wacker's cigar store and the town hall, and onto Buckeye Street. He was depressed by the thought that he was not a part of life in his own town, but the depression did not cut deeply, as he did not think of himself as at fault. In the heavy shadows of a big tree before Dr. Welling's house, he stopped and stood, watching half-witted Turk Smollett, who was pushing a wheelbarrow in the road. The old man with his absurdly boyish mind had a dozen long boards on the wheelbarrow, and as he hurried along the road, balanced the load with extreme nicety.
Easy there, Turk. Steady now, old boy.
The man shouted to himself and laughed so that the load of boards rocked dangerously. Seth knew Turk Smollett, the half-dangerous old woodchopper whose peculiarities added so much of color to the life of the village. He knew that when Turk got into Main Street, he would become the center of a whirlwind of cries and comments, that in truth, the old man was going far out of his way in order to pass through Main Street and exhibit his skill in wheeling the boards.
If George Willard were here, he'd have something to say, thought Seth. George belongs to this town. He'd shout at Turk, and Turk would shout at him. They'd both be secretly pleased by what they had said. It's different with me. I don't belong. I'll not make a fuss about it, but I'm going to get out of here.
Seth stumbled forward through the half-darkness, feeling himself an outcast in his own town. He began to pity himself, but a sense of the absurdity of his thoughts made him smile. In the end, he decided that he was simply old beyond his years and not at all a subject for self-pity.
I may to go to work. I may be able to make a place for myself by steady working. And I might as well be at it, he decided.
Seth went to the house of Baker White and stood in the darkness by the front door. On the door hung a heavy brass knocker, an innovation introduced into the village by Helen White's mother, who had also organized a women's club for the study of poetry. Seth raised the knocker and let it fall. Its heavy clatter sounded like a report from a distant gun.
How awkward and foolish I am, he thought. If Mrs. White comes to the door, I won't know what to say.
It was Helen White who came to the front door and found Seth standing at the edge of the porch. Blushing with pleasure, she stepped forward, closing the door softly.
I'm going to get out of town. I don't know what I'll do, but I'm going to get out of here and go to work. I think I'll go to Columbus, he said. Perhaps I'll get into the State University down there. Anyway, I'm going. I'll tell Mother tonight.
He hesitated and looked doubtfully about.
Perhaps you wouldn't mind coming to walk with me?
Seth and Helen walked through the streets beneath the trees. Heavy clouds had drifted across the face of the moon, and before them in the deep twilight went a man with a short ladder upon his shoulder. Hurrying forward, the man stopped at the street crossing and, putting the ladder against the wooden lamppost, lighted the village lights so that their way was half-lighted, half-darkened, by the lamps and by the deepening shadows cast by the low-branched trees. In the tops of the trees the wind began to play, disturbing the sleeping birds so that they flew about calling plaintively. In the lighted space before one of the lamps, two bats wheeled and circled, pursuing the gathering swarm of nightflies. Since Seth had been a boy in knee trousers, there had been a half-expressed intimacy between him and the maiden, who now for the first time walked beside him. For a time she had been beset with a madness for writing notes, which she addressed to Seth. He had found them, concealed in his books at school, and one had been given him by a child met in the street, while several had been delivered through the village post office. The notes had been written in a round, boyish hand and had reflected a mind inflamed by novel reading. Seth had not answered them, although he had been moved and flattered by some of the sentences, scrawled in pencil, upon the stationery of the banker's wife. Putting them into the pocket of his coat, he went through the street or stood by the fence in the schoolyard with something burning at his side. He thought it fine that he should be thus selected as the favorite of the richest and most attractive girl in town. Helen and Seth stopped by a fence near where a low, dark building faced the street. The building had once been a factory for the making of barrel staves, but was now vacant. Across the street, upon the porch of a house, a man and woman talked of their childhood, their voices coming dearly across the half-embarrassed youth and maiden. There was the sound of scraping chairs, and the man and woman came down the gravel path to a wooden gate. Standing outside the gate, the man leaned over and kissed the woman.
"For old time's sake," he said,
and turning, walked rapidly away along the sidewalk.
"That's Belle Turner,"
whispered Helen, and put her hand boldly into Seth's hand.
"I didn't know she had a fellow. I thought she was too old for that."
Seth laughed uneasily. The hand of the girl was warm, and a strange, dizzy feeling crept over him. Into his mind came a desire to tell her something he had been determined not to tell.
"George Willard is in love with you,"
he said, and in spite of his agitation, his voice was low and quiet.
"He's writing a story, and he wants to be in love. He wants to know how it feels. He wanted me to tell you and see what you said."
Again, Helen and Seth walked in silence. They came to the garden surrounding the old Richmond place, and going through a gap in the hedge, sat on a wooden bench beneath a bush. On the street, as he walked beside the girl, new and daring thoughts came into Seth Richmond's mind. He began to regret his decision to get out of town.
"It would be something new and altogether delightful to remain and walk often through the streets with Helen White," he thought.
In imagination, he saw himself putting his arm about her waist and feeling her arms clasped tightly about his neck. One of those odd combinations of events and places made him connect the idea of lovemaking with this girl and a spot he had visited some days before. He had gone on an errand to the house of a farmer who lived on a hillside beyond the fairground, and I returned by a path through a field. At the foot of the hill below the farmer's house, Seth had stopped beneath a sycamore tree and looked about him. A soft humming noise had greeted his ears. For a moment he had thought the tree must be the home of a swarm of bees. And then looking down, Seth had seen the bees everywhere, all about him in the grass. He stood in a mass of weeds that grew waist high in the field that ran away from the hillside. The weeds were abloom with tiny purple blossoms and gave forth an overpowering fragrance. Upon the weed, the bees were gathered in armies, singing as they worked. Seth imagined himself lying on a summer evening, buried deep among the weeds beneath the tree. Beside him, in the scene built in his fancy, lay Helen White, her hand lying on his hand. A peculiar reluctance kept him from kissing her lips, but he felt he might have done that if he wished. Instead, he lay perfectly still, looking at her and listening to the army of bees that sang the sustained, masterful song of labor above his head. On the bench in the garden, Seth stirred uneasily. Releasing the hand of the girl, he thrust his hands into his trouser pockets. A desire to impress the mind of his companion with the importance of the resolution he had made came over him, and he nodded his head toward the house. "Mother'll make a fuss, I suppose," he whispered. "She hasn't thought at all about what I'm going to do in life. She thinks I'm going to stay on here forever, just being a boy." Seth's voice became charged with boyish eagerness. "You see, I've got to strike out. I've got to get to work. It's what I'm good for." Helen White was impressed. She nodded her head, and a feeling of admiration swept over her. "This is as it should be," she thought. "This boy is not a boy at all, but a strong, purposeful man." Certain vague desires that had been invading her body were swept away, and she sat up very straight on the bench. The thunder continued to rumble, and flashes of heat lightning lit up the eastern sky. The garden that had been so mysterious and vast, a place that, with Seth beside her, might have become the background for strange and wonderful adventures, now seemed no more than an ordinary Winesburg backyard, quite definite and limited in its outlines. "What will you do up there?" she whispered. Seth turned half around on the bench, striving to see her face in the darkness. He thought her infinitely more sensible and straightforward than George Willard, and was glad he had come away from his friend. A feeling of impatience with the town that had been in his mind returned, and he tried to tell her of it. "Everyone talks and talks," he began. "I'm sick of it. I'll do something. Get into some kind of work where talk don't count. Maybe I'll just be a mechanic in a shop. I don't know. I guess I don't care much. I just want to work and keep quiet. That's all I've got in my mind." Seth arose from the bench and put out his hand. He did not want to bring the meeting to an end, but could not think of anything more to say. "It's the last time we'll see each other," he whispered. A wave of sentiment swept over Helen. Putting her hand upon Seth's shoulder, she started to draw his face down toward her own upturned face. The act was one of pure affection and cutting regret that some vague adventure that had been present in the spirit of the night would now never be realized. "I think I'd better be going along," she said, letting her hand fall heavily to her side. A thought came to her. "Don't you go with me. I want to be alone," she said. "You go and talk with your mother. You'd better do that now." Seth hesitated, and as he stood waiting, the girl turned and ran away through the hedge. A desire to run after her came to him, but he only stood staring, perplexed and puzzled by her action, as he had been perplexed and puzzled by all of the life of the town out of which he had come. Walking slowly toward the house, he stopped in the shadow of a large tree and looked at his mother sitting by a lighted window, busily sewing. The feeling of loneliness that had visited him earlier in the evening returned and colored his thoughts of the adventure through which he had just passed. "Huh," he exclaimed, turning and staring in the direction taken by Helen White. "That's how things will turn out.
She'll be like the rest. I suppose she'll begin now to look at me in a funny way. He looked at the ground and pondered this thought. She'll be embarrassed and feel strange when I'm around, he whispered to himself. That's how it'll be. That's how everything'll turn out. When it comes to loving someone, it won't never be me. It'll be someone else. Some fool. Someone who talks a lot. Someone like that George Willard.
Tandy. Concerning Tandy Hard. Until she was 7 years old, she lived in an old unpainted house on an unused road that led off Trunion Pike. Her father gave her but little attention, and her mother was dead. The father spent his time talking and thinking of religion. He proclaimed himself an agnostic and was so absorbed in destroying the ideas of God that had crept into the minds of his neighbors that he never saw God manifesting himself in the little child that, half forgotten, lived here and there on the bounty of her dead mother's relatives. A stranger came to Weinberg and saw in the child what the father did not see. He was a tall, red-haired young man who was almost always drunk. Sometimes he sat in a chair before the new Willard house with Tom Hard, the father. As Tom talked, declaring there could be no God, the stranger smiled and winked at the bystanders. He and Tom became friends and were much together. The stranger was the son of a rich merchant of Cleveland and had come to Winesburg on a mission. He wanted to cure himself of the habit of drink and thought that by escaping from his city associates and living in a rural community, he would have a better chance in the struggle with the appetite that was destroying him. His sojourn in Winesburg was not a success. The dullness of the passing hours led to his drinking harder than ever. But he did succeed in doing something. He gave a name, rich with meaning, to Tom Hard's daughter. One evening, when he was recovering from a long debauch, the stranger came reeling along the main street of town. Tom Hard sat in a chair before the new Willard house with his daughter, then a child of five, on his knees. Beside him, on the board sidewalk, sat young George Willard. The stranger dropped into a chair beside them. His body shook, and when he tried to talk, his voice trembled. It was late evening, and darkness lay over the town and over the railroad that ran along the foot of a little incline before the hotel. Somewhere in the distance, off to the west, there was a prolonged blast from the whistle of a passenger engine. A dog that had been sleeping in the roadway arose and barked. The stranger began to babble and made a prophecy concerning the child that lay in the arms of the agnostic.
"I came here to quit drinking," he said, and tears began to run down his cheeks.
He did not look at Tom Hard, but leaned forward and stared into the darkness as though seeing a vision.
"I ran away to the country to be cured, but I'm not cured. There's a reason."
He turned to look at the child who sat up very straight on her father's knee and returned the look. The stranger touched Tom Hard on the arm.
"Drink is not the only thing to which I'm addicted," he said. "There's something else. I am a lover and have not found my thing to love. That is a big point, if you know enough to realize what I mean. It makes my destruction inevitable, you see. There are few who understand that."
The stranger became silent and seemed overcome with sadness, but another blast from the whistle of the passenger engine aroused him.
"I've not lost faith. I proclaim that. I've only been brought to the place where I know my faith will not be realized,"
he declared hoarsely. He looked hard at the child and began to address her, paying no more attention to the father.
"There is a woman coming," he said,
and his voice was now sharp and earnest.
"I've missed her, you see. She did not come in my time. You may be the woman. It would be like fate to let me stand in her presence once on such an evening as this, when I have destroyed myself with drink, and she is as yet only a child."
The shoulders of the stranger shook violently, and when he tried to roll a cigarette, The paper fell from his trembling fingers. He grew angry and scolded.
They think it's easy to be a woman, to be loved. But I know better, he declared.
Again he turned to the child.
I understand, he cried. Perhaps of all men, I alone understand.
His glance again wandered away to the darkened street.
I know about her, although she has never crossed my path,
he said softly.
I know about her struggles and her defeats. It is because of her defeats that she is to me the lovely one. Out of her defeats has been born a new quality in woman. I have a name for it. I call it Tandy. I made up the name when I was a true dreamer and before my body became vile. It is the quality of being strong to be loved. It is something men need from women and that they do not get.
The stranger arose and stood before Tom Hard. His body rocked back and forth, and he seemed about to fall, but instead he dropped to his knees on the sidewalk and raised the hands of the little girl to his drunken lips. He kissed them ecstatically.
Be Tandy, little one, he pleaded. Dare to be strong and courageous. That is the road. Venture anything. Be brave enough to dare to be loved. Be something more than man or woman. Be Tandy.
The stranger arose and staggered off down the street. A day or two later, he got aboard a train and returned to his home in Cleveland. On the summer evening after the talk before the hotel, Tom Hard took the child to go to the house of a relative where she had been invited to spend the night. As he went along in the darkness under the trees, he forgot the babbling voice of the stranger, and his mind returned to the making of arguments by which he might destroy men's faith in God. He spoke his daughter's name, and she began to weep.
I don't want to be called that, she declared. I want to be called Tandy, Tandy Hard.
The child wept so bitterly that Tom Hard was touched and tried to comfort her. He stopped beneath a tree and, taking her into his arms, began to caress her.
Be good now,
he said sharply. But she would not be quieted. With childish abandon, she gave herself over to grief, her voice breaking the evening stillness of the street.
I want to be Tandy! I want to be Tandy! I want to be Tandy Hard!
She cried, shaking her head and sobbing, as though her young strength were not enough to bear the vision the words of the drunkard had brought to her. And those are our stories for this evening. I hope you enjoyed Respectability, The Thinker, and Tandy. From Winesburg, Ohio, by Sherwood Anderson. Thank you for listening. I'm Jennifer March, and this is not your mother's story time.